All right, let us come back together. Round two, session two. Okay, you should have the handout for session two, Fight or Flight, Early Church and Cultural Engagement. Okay, Fight or Flight. I want to begin, again, several of these books I'm recommending. I got copies, my own personal copies at the back. You can snap a picture of them and if you want to read them. This one just came out. I just finished reading it with a group of people called nonverts. It's a term invented by Stephen Bullivant, who is not a Christian, he's a sociologist, from England, who came over to study this notion of what is deconversion. And I'm sure most of us have heard the term nuns. And based upon the surveys that he has looked at, by 2021, there are 59 million nuns. That is, I know surveys can be contorted in all kinds of ways, but these are those who, when presented with a survey, will check the box that says no religious commitment at all, right? So whatever is motivating them, they at least will sit down in front of a survey and say, I am nothing, right? I identify with nobody. So right now, 59 million nuns, essentially the populations of California and Pennsylvania, first and fourth most populous state, as Bullivant writes about this. That is 44% of 18 to 29-year-olds identify as nuns. Same similar surveys in 1990, less than 10%. 30% of all adults identify as nuns at this point right now. 5% in 1990. But what Bullivant does is doesn't stop there. He asks the question, what percentage of the nuns used to go to church? Used to be involved in a Christian community. We're attending your Tuesday night Bible studies or showing up on Saturday morning for events like this. And what's shocking about Bullivant's study is 41% of 41 million of the 59 million are nonverts that used to be an active member of a Christian church and have left that church. In other words, only 30% of nuns were raised as nuns, which is pretty shocking when you start to look at it. In the book, if you read it, it's pretty challenging to read because there's story after story of those who have left the church for all kinds of reasons. I'm sure you can paint the panoramic view of the reasons people have left the church. But this presents us with a new kind of a dilemma that we face within our culture. Bullivant ends showing the Christian response. His final chapter is this fight or flight kind of contrast. And Bullivant, on one hand, points out books like Rod Dreher's Benedict Option. As an example, if you've read that book, is this, I know Dreher argues for what he calls exile in place. And I know there's a lot of good stuff in Dreher's book. But there, the critique of Dreher, and it's been not by just by myself, but by others, is what about this activism? Are we just going to exile in place? What about sort of the public testimony and public witness of the church? On the other hand, there are those, and Bullivant points them out, that emphasize the political angle. We need a Christian prince. We need someone in charge who is going to usher in politically the kind of world in which we need. And there's lots of good stuff about that too, right? We can have in the Q&A, we can discuss the challenge of losing a Christian culture. I mean, this is debated. You can debate it at your tables. Is it better to move out of a culture where it is nominally Christian, where Christian mores define the culture? Like, we have a general understanding of Christian marriage or a general understanding of Christian virtue that is embedded within the social structures. Once we lose that, is it better or is it worse? Or is it, what challenges do we kind of face? And so there are some that emphasize the political realm. I want to argue this morning that the problem is not an either or. That the problem is we need to think about the spectrum of the way the church engages with the culture. In other words, on your outline, I define what is political theology and public theology. We need both of these. a political theology that thinks about politics Christianly, and a public theology that thinks about our public expression and our public interaction Christianly. And so I want to emphasize both of those things, because in the Benedict option, or in this kind of exile in place perspective, there are good things. And I'll describe here in a minute what I call a cultural discernment happening in the early church. One thing I learned from the early church, and I think about it with my kids every single day, with the world in which surrounds them, I am constantly discerning the virtues and the spiritual expressions that they're interacting with. I think it calls us for the traditional virtue of prudence. We need wisdom in how we live. It can't be an exile in place, and it can't be just a political response. That we need to be cultivating the kind of people that live Christianly embedded within the world. And so this second lesson is first taking a political theology, and then second taking a public theology. And when I talk about public theology, I'm going to talk about two levels of public theology: an intellectual response and a social response, okay? Public theology, on some level, we need to address the intellectuals of our day. We need to address them with reasoned and good arguments. But reasoning people into the kingdom isn't the only way that people will join the church. They also need to see us living Christianly. They need to see marriages flourishing. They need to see children who are raised in the admonition of the Lord. They need to see a grace-filled community that they say, hey, I'm in prison next to Peregrinus, and these Christians keep coming in and giving him money and praying with him, and I think I want to be a Christian. You know, we need a kind of public testimony. Reason is not going to be our only answer, nor is just a public witness. We need arguments. And so the challenge, and I write this in the book, is what I see in the early church is they're addressing each of these things, not losing one for the other. I have another book back there that I get. Paul Williams wrote a book called Exiles on Mission, a British missiologist. He actually shows the last 20 years of missiology, we have waxed and waned in these two kinds of retreat versus political engagement. We've waxed and waned in our missiology. It's a fascinating, in fact, Paul Williams says there are some in the last 20 years that have tried to embrace what he calls a retrenchment, that is try harder, shout louder, you know, do everything we can. We exile and we yell over there. And then he contrasts that with some of you in the early 90s with the emerging church, in which we've got to rethink everything. We need to just like rethink, and we need to absorb the culture. We need to absorb it and become like the culture. And then he talks about laymen. He talks about the challenge methodologically that missions has faced as we oscillate between this kind of fight or flight. And I'm gonna argue there are elements of both that are helpful, that are good, and I'm gonna try to show how the early church walked what I call a cultural sanctification. That's a big word, but that's how I'm trying to describe a middle path in which the church is embedded but living distinctively. I think Williams' Exiles on Mission might be a good summary as well. And I want to do so by beginning to read a short little couple paragraphs from the earliest Christian apologetic text we have outside the New Testament. This is called the Epistle of Diognetus, okay? Diognetus is a pagan. We don't know a lot about this epistle because the second and third century, historically speaking, is there's a lot we don't know. But we have received this epistle, and this is a Christian writing to a pagan trying to explain Christianity. This is a Christian writing to a pagan. And the first few paragraphs, he's distinguishing Christianity from Judaism and from some of these other religious movements. And then in paragraph 5, he begins describing a Christian identity. And he walks through, I think you're going to see here in a little summary, Christians' political theology and public theology kind of encapsulated in a few little paragraphs. So follow along with me. This is Epistle of Diognetus, beginning in paragraph 5 on your reading selections. Christians are not distinguished from the rest of humanity by country, language, or custom. Woo! Whoa! There's not a specific Christian country? Wait, I'm sorry, I thought we all worship Caesar. I thought we were all part of the Roman Empire. You mean Christians can be like Greek and barbarian? Christians aren't just tied to Rome. There can be Christians who are embedded within every country. And this was shocking to the Roman mindset. You mean you can be Christian and not just connected to one geographical and political entity? And the early church is going, yeah. I mean, we're going all over the place. We're going to every people. We're going to every tribe. We're going to show how Christianity can embed itself within any political or social world. Of course, once Christianity embeds itself, that culture begins to, I would argue, be sanctified by the Christian interaction within that world. A very famous missiologist named Andrew Walls wrote a book on the history of missiology, And he shows how whenever the church heads into a culture, the church struggles between two principles, what he calls an indigenizing principle and a pilgrim principle. An indigenizing principle and a pilgrim principle. When the church enters a culture, it indigenizes. It takes up shop, right? It lives there. It begins to express Christian virtue. And through indigenizing itself, it takes on the forms and features, what sociologists call cultural absorption. It absorbs the culture and Christianizes it. Yet at the same time, the challenge for the Christian is there's not one national expression. At the same time, while they're indigenizing, they have a pilgrim principle. They're never at home in this world. No political expression is going to be the perfect and pure kingdom of God that we wait and long for when Christ will come again in glory. So the church is always indigenizing and embracing its pilgrim identity, that there is this tension, and the history of the church is this challenge that we've seen. The church is not distinguished from the rest of the humanity by country or language or custom. There's no Christian language. Growing up in youth group, this was called Christianese, right? Get saved, get right, or get left. I had a great shirt that said, get right or get left, baby. That's right. Christianese. No, there's not a specific Christian language. Christians can speak any language. And for the Roman mindset, it didn't compute. He goes on, for nowhere do they live in cities of their own, nor do they speak some unusual dialect, nor do they practice an eccentric lifestyle. Christians are not crazy, right? You're not doing crazy things. This teaching of theirs has not been discovered by the thought and reflection of ingenious men. Christianity was not discovered through reason. It was not the thinking mind that sat down and said, that's it. Jesus is Lord. No. God appeared in the flesh. God walked. God proclaimed. The Son of God died for us to take away our sin, right? And so Christians are not discovered by the ingenious thought of thinking people, nor do they promote human doctrine as some do. Their doctrine comes from God. They live in Greek and barbarian cities as each one's lot is cast. It's interesting. One of the key distinctions between the pagan mindset and the Christian mindset is divine transcendence and providence. In the Roman mind, this was called fate, but in the modern period, this is something that I argue and I think we need to recover is a strong vision of God's transcendence and God's providence. What the Greeks and the Romans couldn't understand is that there is a God who exists over all, one God who is transcendent, one God who holds this world in his hand, one God who we are the sheep of his pasture, right? We are his children. That view of transcendence. And so the Christians in the early church go boldly into the public square. Look, we live wherever God has placed us. We live in whatever cities God has planted us. And we live, notice he goes on, as each one's lot was cast, we follow the local customs in dress and food and other aspects of life. At the same time, we demonstrate remarkable and admittedly unusual character of their own citizenship. In other words, they eat the clothes, they drink the food. No, back to that. They eat the clothes, they drink the food, they wear the clothes, they eat the food, they drink. When I lived in Scotland, the famous drink in Scotland, they love it. It's called Iron Brew. It tastes like Orange Crush. They get their fish and chips. I did youth ministry there for a while. You get your fish and chips and you get a giant bottle of Iron Brew. And you enjoy the goodness of life. Now for me, I'm a Texan, right? So for me, it's Tex-Mex. And when I lived in Scotland, I missed Tex-Mex. I tried to eat fish and chips. I had my fill of fish and chips. But as I was there, I would long to be back in Texas for some Tex-Mex. And I went to Baylor. So it's not just Tex-Mex, it's Fountain Dr. Pepper, baby. And not just bottle. The bottle has destroyed the Dr. Pepper. Not a plastic bottle. It has destroyed it. I'm talking a giant tub of a Whataburger mug cup that you put under the lever. And divine goodness just flows down. Fountain Dr. Pepper, the perfect balance, right, of goodness. And I would live in Scotland, and I would not eat the clothes. I would wear the clothes. I would eat the fish and chips. I would try to drink the Iron Brew. It was okay, you know. It's like a... But that's how Christians, they take up residence. There's not a specific Christian clothing. There's not a Christian specific food. They look like everyone. Yet they have an unusual character of citizenship. And this for the Roman mindset... Rome was a monism. There is one political authority. Christian political dualism. There is an authority over all. This is Christians' general view of the political world. There is one God who reigns over all, who is transcendent. And this is Romans 13. This is 1 Peter 2. Love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Right? This is a political dualism. Render to Caesar what is Caesar's. Render the Lord's what is Lord's. This is the early church trying to live out that understanding of politics that embraces and recognizes there is one Lord who reigns over all. He is Lord over all people, all nations, all groups. One day, the Father will send the Son who will come again in glory. He will judge the living and the dead, and he will establish one kingdom that reigns over all. This political dualism, then, defined the church's interaction within the public square. So he goes on. They live in their own countries, but only as aliens. They participate in everything as citizens, but endure everything as foreigners. Every foreign country is their fatherland. Every fatherland is foreign. They marry like everyone else. So I'll pause there, and you can see how the Christians understand that I live in this world. We are not what we would say Gnostic. We do not, in kind of a modern Gnosticism, privilege the spirit over the body or privilege the immaterial over the material. We embed ourselves in our world. We participate as citizens. We are active within the world, yet we understand that there is an end to this story, and we're living it. The Lord reigns over all. And thus, this political dualism is the way the church begins to understand its embeddedness within the Roman world. Notice, we marry like everyone else, and we have children, but we do not expose our offspring. It was a common practice. In Rome, marriage was contractual. Inheritance was the only thing that mattered. I need sons through pass on lineage and pass on inheritance. Thus, we only marry for surface reasons, for reasons of inheritance, and then we go out and do whatever we want, okay? We have sons, we have daughters, we don't really like them, so we go do what's called expose the children, where you leave the babies out in the elements. It is a common practice of Christians to go gather the babies and raise them. Christians have a different view of life, of all people created in the image of God. We marry like everyone else. There's tons of discussions of marriage in the early church. Not all of it is worth retrieving. Not all of it is good. But if you get a chance, if you ever go to Rome and you go south to Pompeii, you can actually walk the roads of an ancient Roman city that was buried in AD 70. And you can see brothels on every corner. And you can walk in, you can see the frescoes, the kind of just sheer sexual immorality that you would have walked by. And if there's a great book by Kyle Harper, From Shame to Sin. Harper argues that the most important thing that ultimately led to the transformation of Rome was Christians' view of sex, Christians' view of sex as being a sexual immorality. That Christians' prudence and Christians' understanding of marriage and sexuality was ultimately more than Rome could handle. Now, Kyle Harper does not end it in a way I would say, but he makes that thesis. He would go on to argue that we don't necessarily need to recover that view today, but at least his early chapters makes this case, and I think he's right early on. So Christians come along, and they're embedded in a world that is wild, and they have to express a Christian morality. They marry like everyone else. They have children, but they don't expose their offsprings. They share their food, but not their wives. They will argue, you have one wife and no other. Right? You marry and you remain faithful. In fact, it got so specific that some early church writers were arguing, like, you know, even after the death of a spouse, you don't remarry. Now, I would not take that position necessarily, but they're so trying to show a distinctive view of marriage and of sexual immorality that is trying to be culturally engaging. They are in the flesh, but they do not live according to the flesh. Romans 8 becomes the vision of their spiritual life. You can see there's so many passages here. Romans 13:1, God has instituted government for his own purposes. You can see passages like Matthew 22, render to Caesar what is Caesar's, render to the Lord's what is Lord. Now Romans 8, we've moved into a public theology. How am I to live? You live in the flesh, but not live according to the flesh. And goes, they obey established laws. Indeed, in their private lives, they transcend the laws. They love everyone, and by everyone they are persecuted. They are unknown, yet they are condemned. They are put to death, yet they are brought to life. They are poor, yet they make many rich. They are in need of everything, yet they abound in everything. They are dishonored, yet they are glorified in their dishonor. They are slandered, yet they are vindicated. They are cursed, yet they bless. They are insulted, yet they offer respect. When they do good, they are punished as evildoers. And when they are punished, they rejoice and are brought to life. By the Jews, they are assigned as foreigners. By the Greeks, they are persecuted. Yet those who hate them are unable to give a reason for their hostility. In a word, what the soul is to the body, Christians are to the world. What the soul is to the body, Christians are to the world. Can you imagine talking to a pagan? Christians in the second century are a small sect, barely 1% of the population. Writing to a pagan of the mighty Roman Empire and saying, by the way, this is where it's at. Roger Scruton, the famous philosopher, wrote a book called The Soul of the World. And I think uses some of the same imagery. And what the author of the epistle of Dionysius is saying, look, you want to know where God, the creator overall, is at work? He's at work in the church. He's at work among the people of God. God, the creator of the world, who gave life and breath to everyone who walks in it, is reigning and ruling over all. And God is actively redeeming the world by this little group of people called Christians. This is the soul of the world. This is where, I mean, it is, if you imagine talking to a Roman who sees nothing but the expansion of the Roman Empire. In fact, if you ever read Gibbon's very famous Rise and fall of Rome, he puts the second century as the height of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire will never be as big or as expansive as it is in the second century. It's the great era of peace in Rome. And the mindset is Rome is going to last forever. Caesar is going to be lord over all. And along come the Christians. Well, you know, I hate to break it to you, but the Christians are the soul of the world. As the soul animates the body, the passage goes on, talks about how the soul animates the body. The soul is where God is moving and changing and using the church. And then he closes the second paragraph, paragraph 6, with this little anecdote. Such is the important position to which God has appointed them. It is not right for them to decline it. This little group of people that are sort of hanging out, they are called by God to live Christianly in the world. It is not their prerogative to decline what God has called them to do. And I see so many resonances today, and you can already see the kind of fortitude. This whole text, this epistle, is an apologetic written to an intellectual saying, defending Christianity intellectually, and then trying to understand and explain Christian social engagement, the way the church interacts with the world, and says very boldly, God is at work in the church, the one God creator of it all. It is not right for us to decline our calling in this world. And that's the way the epistle ends. It goes on to give a bit more description about what it means to live Christianly in the world. But I think from that, I hope you can see this division between a political theology, the way we are oriented towards a political world, and a public theology, the way we try to live within society. And so in terms of a political theology, I have on your outline, your notes, it's a firm conviction of divine transcendence and belief in God that God grants authority and an active political dualism. I think one of the differences, in a minute I'll give you a chance to talk about some of this at your table, but one of the differences between the ancient world and today is we actually have the opportunity to have a voice within the political world, to make a contribution in ways the early church didn't have. But I think the challenge we also face on the same end is maintaining that political dualism, recognizing simultaneously that not all our problems are fixed by installing the right people or having the right laws. We need the right people. We need the right kind of people that are living virtuously within society. That laws are not going to fix all our problems, and law are not going to change all things. As Oren said at the beginning, I get a chance to work now. I've taught for the last 12 years in two different seminaries. I taught at Southwestern for a long time and taught at Southern. And now I work for one of the largest religious liberty law firms whose only goal is to defend religious liberty within the public square. I now work for a cultural engagement group that's the outward-facing wing of that organization, of that law firm. And our whole goal is to promote the vision of Christianity as a good within the public square that is underneath and grounding our social and our political world. And I'm compelled, the more programs we have and the more things we do, the need for Christianity as a public good. But how does Christian political dualism play out? I think at the very base, one of the shocking things about the early church is the way they constantly honored and pray for all political authorities. By their act of praying for political authorities, they recognize God's transcendence. They don't say, we always understand why Marcus Aurelius is emperor right now, but I pray for peace because I am so optimistic about the goodness of Christianity and about Christians living publicly in the public square. So they argue, we honor and we pray for political authority, we pay our taxes. You know, in the early church, they constantly talk about living in ways that are above the law. In other words, they use the image of taxes as we invest within some of the social structures of the political world. It doesn't mean we do so unwisely, But it does mean that we are members within this social and political world. We are active in ways that are redemptive of that. And goes another way, they defend religious liberty. There's a book by Robert Wilkin that just came out called Liberty of God in All Things that shows Baptists are historically in the modern period those who defended religious liberty. But Wilkin goes back to the second century and shows that the second century writers were defending religious liberty. They were so optimistic, if we can maintain a defense of religious liberty, we are optimistic about what the church can do. And so they defended religious liberty, and they were optimistic about their expression in the public square. Last, they promoted virtue. The early church understood that it's not just about getting the right people in positions, it's about cultivating the right kind of people, people who live Christianly within the social world. In a minute, we will transition here to a public engagement. That public engagement took on two arguments, intellectual and social. And the church was often making the argument, hey, Caesar, hey, provincial governor, we are your best citizens. If you lose us, you lose everything. We are the ones caring for the poor. We are the ones reaching out to the needy. We are the ones who remain faithful to our spouses. We are the ones who raise our children to be virtuous. We are the ones who are living faithfully in this world according to a moral standard that even you have to acknowledge is virtuous. I call this the moral apologetic. In other words, the church wasn't just rationally defending the faith. They were saying, look at our lives. Now, parenthetically, as I said earlier, not every Christian was living in kind of this expressive way. Not every single Christian was doing that. In fact, many of them kind of fell away, but they were often presenting the argument that that the public expression was a defense of the faith. Now, how did these Christians then begin to express their faith publicly and in the public square? I'm going to walk through one other key text that I think exemplifies this. And after I finish walking through this, we're going to take a few moments to chat at your tables and then do a little Q&A. When someone joined the church, there was often a period of what they called catechesis, a period of discernment. Because the church, because there was no Christian culture, the church had to go through a process of discernment to try to understand why this person was joining the church. And in this process of discernment, I think you can get a glimpse of the social engagement. On your reading selections on this paragraph, I'll walk you through Hippolytus's on the apostolic tradition. This is a description of what early Christian discipleship, or this is like walking into new members class 101 at your church. Welcome to the church. Someone would walk in the second and in the third century and they join the church. When those are brought forward to hear the word, they were brought before the pastors or the teachers of the house, and they were questioned concerning the reason they have come forward, concerning their life, their occupation, their marriage status, whether they are slave and free. In other words, someone joining the church wanted to know, why have you come? Where are you? What's going on with you? What's happening within your life? And then notice, the church said they inquired concerning their works and occupations, whether or not they are ready for discipleship. If someone is a pimp who supports prostitutes, he shall cease or be rejected. In other words, if you want to join the Christian community and you're financially exploiting sexual immorality, we need to have a conversation. We need to have a conversation about that. Not that you immediately reject them, but there needs to be a time in which you explain Christian virtue and what it means to follow Christ and how that virtue then plays out in your life. But he goes on, if someone is a sculptor or a painter, let them taught not to make idols. God has given you the gift of your hands. You use those gifts to the glory of God, but don't use them to promote immorality, worship of idols. In other texts in the early church, they'll say, go, men, paint all kinds of beautiful things. Do beautiful paintings, but don't use those hands to make things that will promote idolatry. Notice the cultural discernment that's going on. When I read this, I can see the challenge of the culture in which we live. What kind of music do you listen to? Does that promote virtue? What kind of songs do you listen to? What kind of groups are you a part of? I'm not saying, and I'm not here to lay down a legalistic way. I think we actually need wisdom and discernment. I think that's the challenge that we have. And that we need to teach our kids and guide our kids, as I try to do, in ways of wisely navigating this distinction between virtue and vice. But it goes on. If someone is an actor or does shows in the theater, let them cease or be rejected. Hollywood has always been pagan. Right? This has been true. You think about Lucian, you think about some of these others. And the challenge is, what was it about Hollywood? Or what was it about the pagan plays? They were filled with all kinds of paganism, all kinds of sexual immorality, all kinds of things. And the church is trying to reason and think discerningly about the world. It's not these legalistic ways of you can do this and don't do that, but it is thinking wisely. How does the pagan vice make its way into the kinds of things we're exposed to? If someone teaches children worldly knowledge, it is good that they cease, but if they have no other trade, let them be permitted. In other words, if you were to be a school teacher, a grammaticus, you had to teach the pagan gods. And that caused the church this challenge of thinking through, okay, how do we handle this? How can I stand up and act as if, how can I teach the pagan gods and act as if these pagan gods are real? Some of our school teachers going through a similar kind of challenge. And notice the church is essentially saying, it's not that you can't do that, do that. Just be wise and discerning in ways in which you do it, right? Be wise and discerning. And it goes on. If someone is a charioteer or someone who takes part in gladiatorial games or anyone involved in any of those things, gladiatorial shows, he shall cease or be rejected. A military man in authority must not execute men. If he is ordered, he must not carry out. He must not take a military oath. This is a whole new challenge. I've talked with so many who work in military who sense the kind of encroaching secularism and the challenges they are facing. Notice the issue is not necessarily a fighting or defending a national government. The issue is taking an oath, because part of the taking an oath is swearing allegiance to Caesar as Lord. So the early church had to wrestle with, to what degree does immorality, to what degree does idolatry, and there's all kinds of discernment that has to go on within a military world, within the military sphere. And he goes on, if someone is a catechumen who wants to become a soldier, he should be rejected, for he's despised God, a prostitute, and so on. Finally, at the end, the catechumens shall hear the word for 3 years. Before you join the church, we need to walk with you for 3 years. I don't advocate you show up to your new members class and say, this is going to be a 3-year process. We want to just make sure you're interested. But you can see the challenge that the early church had of maintaining a faithful witness in the public square. Of what kind of job do I have? How do I raise my children? How do I live embedded lives? And you can see, as much as there's so much I appreciate about Rod Dreher, you can see there's not this, we've got to retreat. There is, we recognize we are embedded. We are a missional people. And we've got to think discerningly and Christianly and organically about our lives embedded. And we use what I say, discernment, thinking through virtue and vice. Living as a community, faithful to the God's call upon our lives. And so, with that, you have a public theology that is an intellectual apologetic, defending the faith in the public square. You also have a social apologetic where the Christian life becomes a way of defending the faith. I'll close with this and then we'll have discussions at your tables. What I think this means, at least three things in the Q&A, we may can tread these lines a little bit. I think we need to think holistically about cultural engagement. We need to think about our interaction with the political, our action with the social worlds. And it can't be an either or. Now, God has called some maybe to one and some to the other, but we have to see we cannot lose if we go full throttle defending a political witness and not think about what it means to cultivate the Christian spiritual life in our world. I think the reason some of us, particularly in the West, have a challenge thinking about this is we haven't lived outside a Christendom for many people, unless you see those who have gone overseas and done missions. In fact, the times I've spent, one of the most edifying things, a couple times a year I go to Tijuana, Mexico and teach missionaries for Radius International that are heading over to unreached people groups. And I'm always fascinated by seeing the joy on their face as they're about to head out typically to a world that is not Western, that is not a Christendom, that is not defined by the mores of Christianity, and they're heading out joyfully, recognizing this kind of full-orbed missiology that has to take place. And so the first thing is, I think we need to think holistically about it. Our political interaction is not going to solve all our problems. In other words, that's what some of my work in the religious liberty field, it's one thing to defend religious liberty, it's another thing actually to have people living Christianly in the world. Those are two kind of things that we need. We need to defend our religious liberty, but also we need you, organic and embedded in the world, living the Christian life faithfully and organically. Number two, I think we need to think long-term. And this doesn't always sell, and it's not that I don't pray for revival. I think revival, I pray dearly that God's Spirit would move. But at the same time, I think long-term. Christ will come again in glory. Have no fear. Have no fear. Christ is going to come again. And thus, it may not happen today, and we are going to walk through some challenges with our families, with our kids, with our work, and we're going to do so as a community, and we're going to do so together, and we're going to do so knowing that this world will not have the final say, that this political entity will not have the final say. We're going to be in the next session, we're going to walk through some early Christian martyrdoms and talk about the virtue of fortitude and courage in the public square that I think is one of the essential things to recover. So, number one, think holistically. Number two, think long term. Number three, think locally. Have you ever done, there's a principle within social teaching called subsidiarity that means problems are often solved at the local level better than at the national level. Those who see problems locally can often solve problems better than those people who are a long way away that have no idea what is going on. And I think that is one thing that I've learned from studying the early church is they were often more engaged with the person sitting across from them or often more engaged with the social world around them and thinking about local interactions, local engagement, thinking about their work, their lives, their children, their schools. In other words, it matters, want to put an either or, but it's just as important who gets on school board as who gets on, becomes president. These kinds of things that local authorities are just as important as national authorities. Think locally, local problems, your school, your work, your people. And that's where I think the early church reminded me that so often we tend to get distracted about what's happening on a national scale when before us, God has called us where we are among the people that we are. Okay, with that is a spectrum. What I want to do now is let's take a 5-6 minute break, 10:50. I want you to come back And I want you to again discuss in your groups two things that you found interesting from early Christian cultural engagement. Mark, set, go.